Bon. From then on, if the stud had rested well and found rich grass, Robert Johnson raced him once in the morning, once late in the afternoon. The horse had been so mistreated he'd lost muscle. So had Johnson. Occasionally, he studied himself in a still pool at the side of a creek, wondering if anyone would even recognize him when he returned to Tennessee with a curly beard and a ragged ear. Johnson found himself half scouting for the future, half retracing his journey. He had seen the best and worst of people, including himself. He'd made mistakes, taken advantage of people, but he'd been no worse than the people he'd encountered, and often better. When the trail he followed widened, he'd soon meet the Arkansas River. Hoofbeats sounded, and a man rode toward him. Johnson hoped he'd pass by with a nod, but the man caught up his reins. Johnson slowed his horse. The man was swarthy, with a fat face, white with Indian features, dressed in the leather and skins of a trapper, but with fancy boots. His horse, a bay mare, broad as a barn, might have been with foal. When he opened his mouth, Johnson could hardly understand his words, even though he knew the man had said, "You have a horse so fine, of Tennessee," for he spoke with an accent foreign to Johnson's ear. Even though the stud was rangy from his hard time, his long legs, his color, his distinctive eyes, green now as the woods they rode through, drew attention. Johnson feared another race, but instead the man said, "So fine you must feed him, yourself as well." Johnson was always hungry, though he'd become as parsimonious with his appetite as his father was. Even the mention of food released saliva in his mouth, clutched his stomach with anticipation. "You know where we can find food?"
"But of course. I am Joseph Baum. I have a small inn for travelers such as yourself, above the river, to keep from the floods."
The inn was anything but small. Johnson had become used to seeing the cramped cabins settlers built in haste while they dreamed of such structures as Bon had erected. He tied the stud to the rail of the broad porch that spanned the building's wide front. The sloping roof rose two stories. When they climbed the few stairs, a wide entry gave way to stairs, more rooms, an open kitchen, as well as a closed one.
"We want for people to stay with us," said Bon. "This would be a good country for settlers, yes? You are maybe a settler?"
Johnson followed the man into the closed kitchen, where a table and chairs promised a meal. He was tempted to launch into his story, from the injustice of the past right up to his unformed plan to take Joe from her brothers and Pa.
"I've been traveling," he began.
Bon interrupted with a sudden call.
"Marie!"
And a woman came down the stairs.
"A guest," Bon said.
Marie was stout, from her wide shoes to her full face. Her rich hair was braided from each side and coiled at her ears. She nodded to him, went to a shelf, and brought bread and cheese from behind a curtain.
"A settler someday," said Johnson.
Bon raised his eyebrows. Marie brought a knife to the table, set it at Johnson's hand, then put her hands together as though prayer might follow.
"Eat," she said. "You look very used to being hungry."
She spoke to Bon in a language Johnson thought might be French, but he wasn't certain.
"She saw your horse from upstairs. Wants to take him to our stable," Bon said. "Give us a chance to get acquainted. My hand will care well for him."
Johnson wondered if the hand was a slave, but he didn't ask his new host. He set to the food at the slow pace of civilization, remembering how he'd eaten before he'd become ravenous, wolfing food like an animal. The cheese was sharp, the bread sour. Bon gave him time to eat, then described the country surrounding his inn. Marie returned, humming, and served them coffee.
"Thank you," Johnson said.
She nodded, still humming a tuneless air.
Tell me about yourself, he said to Bond. Joseph Bond was half Quapaw and half French, one of the men responsible for the treaties that allowed the settlement of Arkansas, where his family had been trading for years. With Marie, he settled down to build the inn and raise children. A percussion of feet came tumbling down the stairs, and three children scurried into the kitchen begging for coffee. Marie shooed them outside, and they tumbled from the room as though tied together by ropes. On the trail, Johnson had seen only sad children. The energy of these young ones was as much jolt as the strong coffee.
A good country it is, said Bond, where we work to have a school to match our church.
You Catholic? Asked Johnson. When Bond nodded, Johnson told him of San Antonio, the mission, and its fine dome. Though for all the splendor, it would soon be a ruin.
I am no priest, as you see, said Bond. We French come to live, not to convert. We do not come to conquer. The Spanish, they have a story of blood and gold. We have a story of women and family.
I'd like that story. Johnson sliced more cheese, tore another hunk of bread, drank coffee even though he was already lightheaded. Only you'd have to add horses.
Of course, said Bond. This will be a story of horses like your own.
Perhaps like mine.
You a horseman?
Bond promised Johnson a trip to the stable to see how his own horse was being treated. Marie brought more bread when Johnson took the last of the loaf to his lips. She'd cut an apple, too. Johnson took a small bite of apple. He pushed the bread away.
I'd best give my stomach time to catch up to this good food, he said.
He'd taken many a bitter apple from trees he passed. This one was almost a peach, juicy and pungently sweet. He washed it down with more coffee.
It's been some time since I ate anything sweet, anything baked. Mostly I've eaten squirrels shot on the trail.
And how long have you been on the trail? Asked Marie.
My story can't all be told in one sitting, said Johnson. I've been away from Tennessee since spring. But clear down into Texas and Mexico, across the Rio Grande.
You are looking for a home? Asked Bond.
He held an apple slice above his mouth as though it were a crescent moon.
I am now, said Johnson.
If he were going to find a home in a place like Bond's, he would tell a story about the future, not the past. Yes, he'd been fugitive. Yes, he'd killed the man who pursued him unjustly. Yes, he was returning to face his accusers. But the important part would be the end, the part yet to be lived.
I believe my sweetheart will take to this part of Arkansas.
We would welcome her, said Marie.
After they'd eaten, Bond brought Johnson to the stable, more a barn, but of stone to the height of a man, then beams of pine cut from the woods around them. Inside, a man pitched hay into an empty stall. Tall and broad, with a brooding profile, the worker was not exactly Negro, but not Indian, French, or Mexican either.
François, said Bond, and the man turned in their direction. This is Johnson. Marie brought his stud to you.
The man set his pitchfork to the floor of the barn and leaned against it, looking toward but not at them, his head cocked slightly.
I thank you, Francois, said Johnson. It is nothing, said the man. Your horse has spirit.
He's worn to the bone, said Johnson.
His spirit is not worn, said the man. I can feel it in his flesh.
Johnson looked at Bond, raised his eyebrow.
Blind, Bond whispered.
But not deaf, said Francois.
And not a slave,
said Bond, approaching his hand, then clapping him on the back.
You may leave whenever you'd like. You know that, Francois.
The big man smiled, as though this was a joke between them.
I'm on my way, Francois said.
I'll see you again, Mr. Johnson.
He leaned the pitchfork by the door and disappeared.
A good hand, said Bond. Knows more about horses than most men with eyes. I thought he'd appreciate your stud.
Is he French like you? Asked Johnson.
Bond looked out the door. French, but not like me. And Indian. Negro and English. No doubt he has some German or something else. Of course, though, we are a country of mongrels. We will turn a man into but one thing. So he is known as Bond's nigger. Though he is not mine, and he has only a little of the Afrikaan.
He's blind, so I guess he'll stay with you, said Johnson.
He stays because I love and trust him like a brother, Bond said. See how he's cared for your stud?
Johnson smiled. Not because the stud was well-watered and had been combed, but because he was dreamily chewing clover hay, his bearing as much of comfort as Johnson's had been in the kitchen, leaning back in a chair, Marie singing behind him.
You'll want a bath, Bond said.
I suppose.
You must, if you expect a bed.
Bond started out the door. Johnson followed. While the men were in the barn, Marie had begun to cook. Onion browned in salt pork. The momentary quell of his appetite forsook him by the time they entered the kitchen. Marie sat before the orange of fat carrots, the lush green of parsley, the dark red of fingerling potatoes, the milky yellow of summer squash. Behind her, dried meat was pounded to a pile of shreds. Bond stood behind her, rested his hands on her shoulders. When she turned her head to smile at her husband, Johnson's homesickness panged his heart.
Travelers from the West, Bond said, have more need of satisfaction than those from the East. Tonight will not disappoint you, unless you should disappear in the bath, an apparition of mud.
He hung a large iron pot on a hook over the fire.
Come.
Bond led Johnson from the kitchen. They went through the hall to a back porch, then to a small building that served as spring house, cool room for milk, butter, and cheese, and where, behind a curtain, a deep tub of rock and mortar, smoothed on the insides and painted with whitewash, was already full of water.
I'll bring a hot bucket or two, but first you must clean yourself from that bucket.
Bond pointed to one of several along the wall.
One of those will do, said Johnson. Don't bother with hot. The tub will drown the vermin, said Bond. But you must make yourself fit for the tub. You're no longer on the trail, Robert Johnson. You must expect some civilization.
He left the spring house. Johnson slowly peeled away his clothing, dropping everything on the stone floor. He'd not undressed completely for a long time. He'd splashed water on his face, waded into streams where rocks and shallows cleaned with rushing water. But he'd let his clothes dry on him while he hurried the stud up the trail to Tennessee. Naked, he was a comical wraith. Thin, his bones jutting from wrist, shoulder, and hip. His feet were black, his knees bruised, his pubic hair knotted, his belly like a little pot, waiting to be filled. His hair had curled along with his beard, and he thought he might be a sight for Joe Benson's sore eyes. He was a sore sight for any eye. Maybe Hiram and Elizabeth would cut his hair, render him a semblance of the young man he'd been when they first met him. He cupped water from the bucket. The accumulation of dirt, sweat, smoke and dried leaves streamed down his trunk, his thighs, his feet, disappearing in the cracks between the rocks. He stepped over the lip of the tub and lay down in the cool water. Bond was right. He would have to learn to tolerate some civilization, slow as it could be, for he'd been in a hurry all his life. He'd hurried from bed at night to race horses in the roads and pasture tracks around Pleasant View. He'd hurried from his father's house after his mother died. He'd hurried to build his cabin, stake his claim on contested ground. He'd hurried his courtship with Joe and his desire to make her his wife. That had stirred up the Bensons' plot to ensnare him in crime, and so he'd hurried away on the stud. Once he'd killed McDonald, he'd hurried home, loping toward Joe Benson, still faithful, still pregnant with their child, scheming for him just as he was for her, both ready to make a home in just such a place as he found himself in the pine bluffs above the Arkansas River. Though Johnson yearned for Tennessee, the food he'd eaten, the soak in water, the unbinding of muscle and tension, made him drowsy. He had not been so content since those brief days of spring when he'd met Joe in the pool in the creek between their properties. Bond clomped across the stone floor. Johnson opened his eyes and covered himself, but Bond pulled the curtain open just enough to pour a bucket of hot water into the tub. He tossed a chunk of yellow soap into the water.
"Take your time. I have left a robe. Marie will wash your clothes as soon as the stew begins its simmer. And Francois, he says your gold is safe with him."
"I'm trusting all of you," said Johnson to the curtain.
"You are wise. We want guests and settlers. We do not sit upon wayfarers. We care for their horses, their tack, their pistols and rifle."
Bond waited, hand on the curtain.
"You think I'm a desperado," Johnson said. "I have been, and I may have to be in Tennessee. Circumstances have been hard on me, but I am not a hard man. I can show you lowland or bluff, game, bear, deer, muskrat, duck, good land for growing crops, a fine valley with rock to quarry, timber to cut."
Bond dropped the curtain. Outside, Bond called to his children.
"The pigs," he shouted. "They need water. Do not disturb the man at his bath."
Johnson lay quiet. They whispered into the spring house, filled buckets, tempted each other to laughter, then hurried away. Johnson had been a solitary child, his mother his only companion once his brother died. She could make him laugh. He and Joe had laughed together in the creek, splashing naked after they'd joined their bodies. He'd been both man and child then, she woman and child. He scrubbed himself, lather and foam, until his skin was raw. He rose from the tub and parted the curtain. He dried himself and put on the robe Bond had left. He'd been promised a hearty stew. He would know the laughter of children, a bed for sleep. Such simple gifts, yet they had eluded him for many months. He was but several days' hard ride from Hiram and Elizabeth, then on to Tennessee. And yet, as he contemplated home, he felt home. He would be an Arkansasier, drawing his Tennessee line, his own blood and the studs, into a new line, in a new territory, like so many before him.